It's day 91. A lack of consensus over how to wrangle oil tax reform keeps lawmakers in Juneau. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 18th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Wasilla man is attacked by a grizzly bear.
It was reported to the troopers that the injuries were fairly significant.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Lawmakers blew through their 90-day session last night and are back at work today, day 91, trying to bring a budget together that all sides can agree to. APRN's Juneau correspondent Andrew Kitchenman joins me now to talk about the big stumbling blocks. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Lori.
So what's the most contentious issue right now for lawmakers?
The big holdup is the bill that would change taxes and tax credits for the oil and gas industry. The Republican-led House Majority Caucus has been unable to craft a bill that its members can agree on. And it gets more complicated because the final budget will likely require the state to draw about $1.5 billion from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. That's going to require three-quarters of the House to vote for it. And this gives House Democrats, who are about a third of the members of the House, leverage in the outcome of the oil and gas tax credit bill.
Are you hearing that any progress is being made?
Yes. Both House Speaker Mike Chenault and House Minority Leader Chris Tuck say that it's possible that all of this work could get done this week. And the governor's also optimistic. He says that his administration's playing a tactical role in supporting talks among legislators by providing the information on the impact of various proposals that they need, and all that's being discussed privately.
Andrew, are there any details emerging about what a compromise could look like?
Tuck says that elements of what the Senate Finance Committee did with its version of the bill, scaling back tax credits for Cook Inlet oil producers, could be part of a compromise. Governor Walker also likes these provisions. But the industry has used near apocalyptic language in describing that particular aspect of the bill. And in addition, there's some support in the House for scaling back production tax credits on the North Slope. And that would go even further than what Walker has proposed, since this would change the key feature of the system put in place by Senate Bill 21 in 2013. It's not clear whether that's still in the picture, but it is the one House amendment that would save a large amount of money that received the most votes. Walker says that if the legislature doesn't close the budget gap by making changes like raising the minimum tax paid by oil and gas companies, then it will have to come up with other ways to close the gap.
What about other issues? Are there other holdups?
Not really. It's really the oil and gas tax credit bill that's at the center of why the legislature is still here in Juneau. There are other differences in the budget, like there's the $50 million cut to the University of Alaska, but those could be resolved once the oil and gas tax credit bill is done. Now, for most Alaskans, the most immediate effect of the remaining bills under discussion is that they would see a 50% cut in the permanent fund dividends. And legislators know that this is going to be very politically unpopular. It'll be easier for them to make a case that residents will have to make sacrifices if industries like oil and gas, mining and fisheries also make sacrifices. There's also a mystery proposal out there that would affect public employee pay, but no details are available about that yet.
Andrew, are lawmakers figuring on staying in Juneau until they're done, or is a special session being discussed?
Legislators would like to be done this week, or maybe a little bit more than a week. if it takes more time than that, then there very well could be a special session. Now, theoretically, the legislative majorities could pass a budget without any minority support by closing the budget gap with money from the permanent fund earnings reserve. This would run the risk that Governor Walker would veto the oil and gas tax credits for the next year, which would push them off into the future. And it could also lead to credit downgrades for the state, since it shows that the state may not be able to sustain its budget. This would make it more expensive for the state to borrow and worsen investors' confidence in the state. These are things that legislators want to avoid as of today.
APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reporting from Juneau. A man was attacked by a bear near the Denali Highway over the weekend. Alaska State Trooper spokesman Tim Despain says 77-year-old Glenn Bond of Wasilla was bear hunting Friday afternoon near mile 68 when he was mauled by a grizzly.
It was reported to the troopers that the injuries were fairly significant.
Despain says the attacking bear was shot dead by another hunter.
Bond was then driven to the Denali Highway by snow machine, where he was flown by LifeMed to Anchorage.
Despain says friends of the victim, accompanied by Alaska Department of Fish and Game and state trooper representatives, returned to the attack site Saturday and retrieved the bear carcass. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a week-long look at reforming foster care in Alaska.
The only thing that's different, really, is that I think we're doing a better job at keeping children safe.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs and dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people.
Middle Kuskokwim River Villages reported that river ice is beginning to move out in what is expected to be the earliest river breakup on record for those villages. Bethel Search and Rescue Chief Mike Riley posted online the Kuskokwim River ice around Aniak, Napaimute, Chuathbaluk, and Kalskag was moving around 4 p.m. yesterday. According to the National Weather Service breakup database, the earliest breakup for Kalskag was April 22nd in 1940. Those records go back to 1938. Riley says the ice should be completely out within a few days. As the Kuskokwim River ice continues to shift and rot, search and rescue volunteers have stopped searching for 26-year-old Tuluksak resident Dylan Lamont. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
Bethel Search and Rescue Chief Mike Riley says recovery efforts for Dylan Lamont just below Tuluksak have been suspended due to deteriorating river conditions at the search site.
They are kind of suspended the search for Mr. Lamont, maybe a week or so, until conditions get better. And they have pulled their equipment from there because of safety reasons, getting there, because factor of that, their safety part for the searchers.
Alaska State Troopers say three people had broken through the Kuskokwim River ice near Tuluksak on the 10th. A witness assisted two of the passengers, but Lamont did not make it out. It is presumed by responders that he had drowned, and searchers have continued recovery attempts since Monday, April 11th. Bethel Search and Rescue sent an underwater camera and other equipment. Alaska State Troopers did not assist in the recovery efforts for safety reasons. Search and Rescue Vice President Fritz Charles conducted an aerial survey of the Kuskokwim and says the ice shifted on some parts of the river.
There should be no traveling whatsoever at this point. There's a lot of open holes, upper and lower end of Strait Slough, and the ice did shift within the half hour that we were flying at the upper end of Strait Slough, so there should not be any snow machine or any kind of vehicle traffic on the river.
Fritz says he expects a thermal or mushout for this year's breakup, where the lower river washes out first, saying the water upriver is lower than it used to be. Alaska State Trooper Pilot Arthur Abalama says even if the ice clears up quickly downriver, people should expect more ice to come from upriver.
Looks like it's going to open up down here before it does upriver, and if the ice clears enough to where anybody can boat, just be aware that there's still a lot of ice to come down from upriver.
Meteorologists expect the area temperatures over the weekend to stay above freezing. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
This week on Alaska Public Media, we'll be looking at the foster care system, both some of the current problems and some of the solutions. For the first part of the series, Fostering Our Future, Urban Affairs reporter Ann Hillman spoke with officials at the Office of Children's Services about the current status of foster care in Alaska.
Nearly 3,000 children are in out-of-home care in Alaska, an all-time high. And as a result, caseworkers are overburdened and can't give foster kids or foster families the attention they need.
If you give a worker twice as many cases as is reasonably able to be done, the entire system is going to suffer.
That's Travis Erickson, the operations manager for OCS. He's been with the agency for 17 years and says the problem isn't new.
No, I could have given the same speech 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and 15 years ago. The only thing that's different, really, is that I think we're doing a better job at keeping children safe, and the system is being taxed harder than it has been probably ever.
Erickson says multiple factors are driving up the numbers statewide. One is OCS is screening more reports of abuse to see if the government needs to intervene sooner. They're trying to reduce rates of repeat maltreatment. He says substance abuse is the number one reason kids end up in foster care.
But it's really not clear how much the heroin growth and these designer drugs are really affecting the numbers. But we're concerned about it right now.
He says heroin could be adding to the numbers or could just be taking the place of other drugs. They'll have new data analysis tools available in a few months to make that determination. The end result is the court system is determining that more kids should be placed in out-of-home care. And with incoming case numbers increasing, it's harder for caseworkers to look after the kids who are already in foster care and see if they can safely be reunited with their parents or sent to another long-term family. They just don't have the time, so the kids just stay in the system longer.
If you were to go and interview any one of our workers and say, hey, you know, are you keeping up on your workload? You'd probably get some gasping, some bewildered looks, and then say something along the lines of, no, I'm not keeping up. I'm trying my best, but no, I'm not able to keep up.
OCS Director Christy Lawton says they're seeing similar problems in both rural and urban Alaska. In rural areas, especially Western Alaska, it's exacerbated by smaller offices and an inability to recruit local people in small communities to work with an agency that's often mistrusted. Lawton says they end up hiring people from outside of Alaska who don't stay long enough to really build trust with the communities.
Yeah, they're typically not staying there long enough to form that kind of relationship, to be honest with you, and that then really decreases our ability to have the most successful interventions and to work with the community in a way that, you know, is going to produce better results all around. So it's unfortunately a pretty vicious cycle that we've been really stuck with finding real solutions that work.
Erickson says ultimately the solution is preventing child neglect and abuse instead of just reacting to it. In his view, that's not solely the job of government. It's up to the whole community.
I would really like us to kind of wake up as a state and say we've got to do something different. And that's going to take some radical thinking.
In the next part of the series, we'll explore ways that community members in rural and urban Alaska are trying to do just that. And we'll look at ways people are trying to improve the outcomes for kids who are already in foster care. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
As lawmakers finish off their spending plan for state operations, a wide variety of programs are considering the impacts of budget cuts. One is the state public health center system, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Southeast Alaska community of Wrangell has been without a full-time public health nurse since the previous staffer left in March. Fill-ins from other centers are spending a few days there every other week. One is Susan Bergman, a nurse manager who supervises that center from Ketchikan.
I'm not recruiting at this point. I haven't received permission to do so. And they are still waiting for final decisions to be made in the House and the Senate with their budget.
The nursing program faces a 15 to 20% reduction in its annual budget of about $30 million. Chief of Public Health Nursing Linda Warman says that will affect the level of service provided to low-income Alaskans and those without insurance.
There most likely will be closures this year like there were last year, but I will honestly say it does depend on what the final dollar figure is.
A smaller budget cut made last year caused the 10-nurse Seward Public Health Center to close. Warman says her agency is working on plans for further reductions, but isn't ready to identify locations or positions. She says such decisions are based in part on need, such as communities with high tuberculosis rates. Bergman says that's not much of a problem in Southeast, but it is in parts of Western Alaska.
They also look at, are the community partners able to provide the services that public health provides, which in Wrangell, the answer is yes, we have other providers.
Warman says the main focus of the public health program is on younger Alaskans, though others can still find some help.
We're still going to do immunizations. We're going to do reproductive health through the lifespan. We're going to make sure that if somebody does call, we're going to be able to tell them what services are available in their community if we cannot be their safety net provider.
The state has about 190 nursing positions at 22 public health centers. Warman says those jobs make up about 80% of her agency's budget.
This is an unprecedented reduction. However, we still believe that public health nursing is very valuable for our state. And so we said, what can we do with this? Because we all know what the state budget looks like. And it's not that nursing was targeted in any way.
Along with Wrangell, Haynes, Cordova, and Valdez are one-nurse sites with open positions at this time. But Warman says that doesn't necessarily mean they'll close. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Natural factors are credited with growing the moose population in the Yukon Charley Rivers National Preserve. Preserve wildlife biologist Matt Sorum says the latest data from moose population surveys conducted every 3 years shows more moose in a 3,000 square mile corridor along the Yukon and Charley Rivers.
There was a 13% increase since the last survey, and on average about 38% more moose over the long-term average throughout the park.
Sorum says the survey area is far from areas where the state conducts predator control, and he attributes the moose population increase to major wildfire and flood activity in the last decade.
Good quality moose habitat often occurs 10 to 30 years after a fire because of the regrowth and regeneration of willows or birch. Secondly, there was a large flood about 5 years ago, and there was a lot of scouring of the riverbed, and so that's probably promulgated new growth of willows.
Sorum says there's been a similar increase in the adjacent Yukon Flats refuge, cautioning that although conditions are conducive to more moose, the Yukon Charley Rivers Preserve population is still considered low density, well less than one moose per square mile. The Togiak herring fishery opens yesterday, the earliest date on record. The herring showed up unexpectedly last week and have already begun to spawn all over Bristol Bay's northern coast. As KDLG's Dave Benninger reports, Fish and Game, processors, and the fleet got caught flat-footed and are hustling out to try and make a season.
No matter which aspect of this herring fishery you look at, 2016 sets a new record. First date the biomass was spotted coming into the district used to be April 19th. First date spawn was observed. It was April 23rd. Earliest that commercial effort got underway, in 1980 and 2003, harvests were recorded on April 25th. Last week, private pilots flew in with the news that not only were the herring here, but they were already spawning all over the place. Fish and Game Area Management Biologist Tim Sands flew a survey Sunday, documented 37 miles of spawn, and open the seiners and gill netters to commercial effort by the evening.
It's a real head-scratcher for us as far as much spawn has been reported being seen and where the spawn's happening. But there's clearly enough fish around to spawn all those places, so we opened it up. I know there's a little bit of a storm coming, so that might delay things further, but it's open now so people can go when they're ready, and we'll just see what happens.
The problem is neither the fleet nor their buyers are on the fishing grounds yet. Gillnetters like Frank Woods were hoping to leave Dillingham by the end of this week and get over there several days ahead of time.
Frustration. That's all I got to say is everybody's trying to play catch-up right now, and it's interesting for sure.
Sea surface temperature plays an important role in the timing of the Togiak herring's spring migration to the spawning grounds along the coast. A month ago, the department cautioned stakeholders that the warm sea surface temperatures and low sea ice levels were so far from normal that predicting the run timing would be impossible. Purse Seine skipper Robert Hyeno says the herring are fickle, but no one was expecting this.
You know, they say they're pretty sensitive to water temperature, so I'd have to think that that had a large part to do with it. You know, last year it was fairly warm, but it wasn't really that early. I think we fished on the 29th, so.
Hyeno's fished for Togiak herring since 1978. By and large, this is a month of May fishery. He was hustling his crew for a Sunday afternoon departure from Dillingham for the day-long trip to the grounds, hopeful that his processor was getting its act together quickly, too. Hyeno was a little upset by circumstances he thinks could have been prevented.
I think the big thing that's disappointing is, from what I understand, there's very little or no money that the state has budgeted for this fishery. So the largest, herring fishery in the state of Alaska? That's very disappointing, you know, and then you listen to what they're doing down in Juneau and they're talking about buying an office building and reluctance to reduce tax credits and things like that, but they can't put a few dollars in the herring fishery.
Fish and Game did cut all funding for Togiak herring management this year, down from about $30,000 last year, which is still way down from a heyday 15 years ago or so. A private industry donation of $10,000 will allow area manager Tim Sands a couple of survey flights. Would he have flown to spot for herring sooner had the funding been there?
You know, based on the sea surface temperature and everything like that, we probably would have considered flying, especially after we heard some reports of seals with fish in their bellies and stuff like that. I guess the short answer is certainly budgetary constraints are a factor in what we're doing.
There aren't many participants in the Togiak herring fishery these days, just 21 seiners and 3 gill netters signed up, expecting a price around $50 a ton. Whether they and their buyers get to the grounds in time to find some mature fish with good roe will get sorted out this week. Most say they'll still try. As one skipper put it, when the going gets weird, the weird get going. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
A fisherman on a Dutch harbor-based trawler died last week, but not while working at sea. Divers found his body underneath the dock where his employer's boat is. Police are still investigating, but it appears the crewman fell in the water unseen after returning from a night out in town. KUCB's Greta Mart reports.
The trawler named Margaret Lynn returned to Dutch Harbor from a fishing trip on April 10th. The following night, 35-year-old Matthew Warren was out at the Norwegian Rat Saloon drinking PBRs. In the morning, his vessel captain realized Warren was missing and started looking for him around town. But a hat belonging to the crewman was found on the dock.
And that combined with some information that officers obtained from the captain, other crew, taxi drivers that they talked to, they put together that it was quite likely he had returned to the dock early in the wee hours of the morning.
Unalaska Deputy Police Chief Jennifer Shockley says when the captain alerted police, the search was focused on the marina from the start. Police brought in commercial divers who recovered Warren's body from under Carl E. Moses Boat Harbor's B dock around 7:30 p.m. Tuesday.
This is the kind of tragedy that we see, I want to say, probably about every 2 years. Sometimes we find people who are reported missing. Sometimes we don't. Almost all the times that we have a situation like this where somebody falls into the water in the night, we almost never have anybody who saw anything, which is, you know, part of the reason why they end up this way.
Shockley says Warren's father called to receive the news. Not much else is known about Warren other than he lived in Anchor Point, Homer, and Fairbanks at various times in his life. He had been fishing on the Margaret Lynn for about a year. Word of the fisherman's death spread quickly around the island and hit his friends and fellow crewmen hard.
When you hear that it happened to somebody that's a fisherman, but in that way, it's even like it's worse, you know? Because at least out there, you're putting your life for what you do every day. You make money. That's what you do. That's your life. You go out there and you risk it. Somebody like that, it's pretty sad.
A fisherman in his early 30s, Eric Valenzuela, says he's been crabbing out of Dutch Harbor for the past 5 years.
It's happened to me where I know that it could have been an accident. I left the bar, you know, had a couple of drinks. You don't even have to be drunk. I mean, it can just happen in the middle of the night. You know, you step on a buoy or you try to cross, you're like, oh, I'm good. I've been doing this for many years. I mean, it don't matter if you've been doing it for many years. All it takes is one little slip.
A bartender there at the Rat the night Warren died says he was not visibly intoxicated when he left the bar. She says Warren got into a taxi with another local and left. The U.S. Coast Guard announced in October that over a recent year-long period, not one Alaskan commercial fisherman had perished at sea while working. But between 2000 and 2009, 133 commercial fishermen died while working in Alaskan waters, says the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH. One-third died from falls overboard.
And not a single one of those guys was wearing a life jacket when he died.
That's NIOSH's Ted Teske. Last fall, he was in Dutch Harbor to survey fishermen about their current use of life jackets. Teske says, anecdotally, more crewmen in the Dutch Harbor fleet are wearing PFDs around the clock. The latest designs are in the form of suspenders, easy to work in, and forget you're wearing. But who wears a PFD while docked? Matthew Warren did not.
Certainly, if he'd been wearing one, he would have had a much greater likelihood of survival. But the reality is that most of the people who work out here on the fishing boats, when they're in port and they're simply getting on and off of their boats in order to, you know, go to the grocery store, go to the restaurant, go to the bar, they're not wearing a PFD to do that.
Deputy Chief Shockley says at this point in the investigation, there's no reason to suspect Warren's death was other than an accident. His body was flown to Anchorage for an autopsy, and Shockley says it'll be a few weeks until they know more information on the precise cause of death. Reporting in Unalaska, I'm Greta Mart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Charles Enoch in Bethel, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Greta Mart in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska's salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. Alaska Public Media is seeking donations for our 2016 Big Alaska Statewide TV Travel Auction to be held on May 19th and 20th. We're looking for trips, accommodations, activities, and adventures. Your generous donation will help us in our commitment to growth and excellence in programming on Alaska Public Media. There's more information online on our events page on our website at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.